Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I pick up the morning newspaper and I read the first headline here. That fault lines emerge as industry groups blast plan to create consumer agency. What planet are you living on? The very people who created the damn mess are the ones now arguing that consumers ought not to be protected.
Senator Dodd yesterday on the floor on the occasion of Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner's testimony about new rules for Wall Street. Now, for the industry, the rules go too far, as Dodd was just reflecting. For some, though, not far enough. And my first guest today is in that camp, enough so that the president's economics advisor, Larry Summers, needed to respond to him by name on NPR yesterday. We will play that clip in a minute. It's New York Times and NPR business columnist Joe Nocera. New York Times business columnist Joe Nocera. Let's get this right. Also an NPR commentator on Weekend Edition. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. You just told me something I didn't know.
What's that?
What did Larry say?
Well, I guess we better play the clip here. Robert Siegel threw at Summers yesterday on All Things Considered your quote that the Obama plan is little more than an attempt to stick some new regulatory fingers into a very leaky financial dam rather than build the dam itself. Do you want to elaborate on that a little before we play Larry Summers' response?
Sure. My basic problem with the plan is it does a million little things, but aside from the new Consumer Protection Agency, it does no one big thing. And it accepts the world as it is instead of the world as it ought to be. And so, things like CDO squared, which just seem insane to the normal person.
These bizarre, fancy derivatives.
Yeah, derivatives that are built around other derivatives. Nothing's really done to rein them in or stop them, or nobody's sort of rethinking, does this make any sense to do this? And the main thing I was trying to say in the column was, in the 1930s, Roosevelt didn't accept the world as it was. He said, we need to reform. We need to change the way banks in a radical way, and that's what they did. And my feeling was, this doesn't do that at all.
So Robert Siegel cited some of that to Larry Summers yesterday, mentioning your name. And here was Summers' reply, and very important now, Joe, I want you to listen very carefully to see if he pronounces your name right.
Respectfully, the clamor of concern, particularly about the consumer regulation from financial industry lobbyists, suggests that they don't share Mr. Nocera's view. More profoundly, this is about reducing leverage, causing there to be more capital, getting rid of the gaps, and that's exactly what we're going to do. I think financial practice is going to be very, very different, and that when we look back a few years from now, we're going to see a very different American financial industry, and this bill is going to be an important part of the reason why.
Okay, so first of all, is it Nocera or Nocera? He called you Joe Nocera. Did we lose Joe? Joe, you there? Larry Summers blew him away. We'll have to get Joe Nocera back. And we'll ask him about the hot response from lobbyists that Larry Summers just referred to there. And we heard a few minutes ago Senator Dodd railing at those lobbyists for trying to resist this new financial consumer protection agency, at very least, and whether that signals fundamental change. And listeners, while we're getting Joe back on the line, we want your help. And we're going to keep this going over a period of a few weeks. Let's redesign Wall Street together. We have a page on our website, since this debate is now really just beginning in Congress. What should the new banking rules be? Add a rule that you think is important to not crash the economy in the future, like the way it's been kicked to the ground now. Or you can call it into us right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. to put the world as it should be rather than it is, what rule do you think is important to include in the Wall Street overhaul? 212-433-9692 or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. That webpage is going to have some life as we continue this project for some weeks to come. John Nocera, are you back?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Brian. I'm on a cell phone today.
And, that's okay. And it is Nocera, isn't it? Or is it
Nocera? It most certainly is.
It's not Nocera, like Larry Summers said.
Actually, it is Nocera.
Nocera. He said Nocera.
Yeah. I'll give him a pass on that.
Okay, that's okay. And you didn't know. You didn't know previously that he had said that on ATC.
No, I was working on my column yesterday, so I was, I'm always out of touch on Thursdays.
You need to Google yourself more often. So do you want to keep the conversation going with Larry Summers?
Yes, I do. I think the bringing up the consumer agency as proof that the banking industry is not happy is a little bit of a red herring. Of course, they're not going to be happy with a consumer agency. That makes perfect sense. But and that will affect them on the margins, no question about it. But the big stuff, should we have banks that are too big to fail? Let's just take that. I mean, you would think that's a pretty darn important question, given the place we're in right now, given how much money has had to go to prop up institutions that were too big to fail. They have not dealt with the moral hazard issue at all. And I find that very troubling. And secondly, on the whole issue of derivatives, they haven't done anything that that would rein in or change the fundamental nature of derivatives. There may be less leverage, but in essence, they're not going to change. So, you know, I would basically say it is not a given that the financial system will be fundamentally changed by this.
All right, listeners. Our listeners, Joe, are calling in already with suggestions for what would mean rules of the road that were really different for Wall Street and other banks. And let's hear some of them. Rob in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
To me, one of the most important things, not the only important thing, is that no financial institution, banks or otherwise, should be allowed to invest any more than an extremely small percentage of the total assets under their control in derivatives or any exotic financial instrument.
Joe, you want to react to that? Yeah.
I think Steve Pearlstein made a very interesting and important, I thought, comment in the Washington Post this morning. He's a columnist for the Post, where he said, look, you know, we haven't really even had a thorough airing or investigation of, you know, what the actual bank practices were and, you know, what exactly it was that got us in all this trouble. And so, you know, while in theory I would agree with the caller, it sounds good, it's a little – I want to know more. I mean, I don't feel like I know enough. And also, not all derivatives are exotic. Some of them are plain vanilla. Some of them have actual, some of them have legitimate uses. A lot of the stuff that got us into trouble were these very arcane, one-of-a-kind, customized derivatives that were completely untradeable and that depended on rating agency approval. And that's another whole issue. They haven't even talked about what they're going to do about the rating agencies, which are really at the heart of some of these problems.
Rob, thank you for your suggestion. Now, Fran and Holmdel, I think, wants to talk back to you and all of the what she might see as extra or exaggerated concern about all of this. Fran, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, touche with the previous caller. It's all about disclosure with derivatives and stuff. If people know exactly what is in the package, then they can choose whether they want to invest in it or not. But I think one of the biggest things that happened is the hysteria created by the media. The sky is falling. People took their money out of the market. Oh, my goodness, your 401k is going to be trash. People pulled their money out of the market, just like in 1929. And that is the biggest thing, and it's the media. because anybody knows the ships are still sailing, the companies are still functioning, but just watching the systematic trashing of GMC and Chrysler is appalling. And a neighbor of mine has a dealership, and you're done. Your franchise is over. How can they break contracts and do that kind of thing?
And that's the media's fault, Fran?
To some extent it is, because people are not feeling secure, and I think there's a lot to be said. For example, Zicam. Oh, no, you can't breathe if you use Zicam. Well, Rush Limbaugh was advocating that. And, I mean, you have a cold, you swab your nose, and that's it. These people are putting it in their nose every 3 hours. It's 100 people affected by that, but the whole pharmaceutical company that has Zicam is probably going to be damaged by that.
Well, Joan O'Sara, did we do this?
Well, with all due respect, I really think in the financial crisis, the media really just reported the news and really didn't fan the flames. The news was pretty terrible.
Oh, I'd go further than that. I think that if the media had done a better job of ferreting out the excesses that were there for people who wanted to see them, and some blogs had it, and a few media, then earlier on, the sky wouldn't have wound up falling in the way that it did.
I would totally agree with that, but it's wrong. It's just wrong to say that because of the media, people took their money out of their accounts. First of all, people taking their money out of their accounts is not what caused the financial crisis. Second of all, when you had an event in mid-September, for instance, the Reserve Money Market Fund breaking the buck, I mean, that's what caused people to get scared. Money market funds are never supposed to. They're supposed to look and feel like savings accounts. And you know, those are the events that were scary. And as for derivatives, I mean, you know, really, the small investor, the average investor, had nothing to do with that aspect of the market. It was all highly paid, you know, big time professional investors who all went on a bout of delusion. Really, in thinking they were worth something that they weren't worth. So, you know, it's just hard to see how the media is at the heart of this.
All right, Joe Nocera or Nocera, whatever. Thanks a lot. will we hear you on with Scott Simon tomorrow morning?
No, they didn't ask me to come on.
Not this week. Okay. Joe Nocera, thanks a lot. You can hear him a lot of Weekend Edition mornings on Saturdays with Scott Simon, not this particular one. You can read him in the New York Times. Joe, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And we continue on this now with two other guests, Diane Brady from Business Week and Tom Braithwaite from the Financial Times, who's got a bit of an international perspective. Is all our money going to flow overseas because of new rules on Wall Street? So, Diane, welcome back. Tom, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Morning to you.
And, Diane, want to talk more about the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, a brand new regulatory body. I've seen it described as the first official seat ever for consumers at the banking regulatory table. What would it actually do?
Well, what it's going to do is provide some clarity on mortgages, credit cards. We've heard a lot about subprime mortgages and these ARMs and these basically exotic mortgages that people were getting into with no idea of what the repercussions would be down the road, that their payments would be going up in some cases exponentially. Ditto for the credit cards. There's a feeling that a lot of people, you know, not just you have to read the fine print, but in some cases the fine print just actually isn't there. So I think that's one of the best elements of the proposal, is the fact that consumers now will have more clarity, and more importantly, mortgage companies and credit card companies will not be allowed to have some of the practices that really did take advantage of our gullibility.
So let's do a little thought experiment here. If that had been in effect over the past 5 years, what might have been different with the housing bubble and credit default swaps and CDO squareds and all of that?
Swaps, I'm not sure, because that's not so much of a consumer angle. But let's take the mortgages, for example. We're hearing many cases of people who would have qualified for the jumbo mortgages, for the fixed-rate mortgages, who were basically, in some cases, suckered into these no-money-down, no-interest mortgages, I mean, all sorts of adjustable-rate mortgages, without fully understanding what they were getting into. I think this agency will have impact there. More importantly, I think, is on the credit card front, where you have people whose payments start to escalate if they don't make a payment within 30 days. You're already seeing rules come out where credit card companies will have to tell you, if you don't pay this minimum payment, here's what you're going to end up paying over the life of, you know, what you currently owe. That's important information for people to have. It encourages long-term thinking. More important, it encourages us to simply know what we owe. It lets you know the options. So I think we don't know yet what they're going to do. It has a broad mandate, this agency, but I clearly think one of the big issues with consumers is we have not had enough information, and the companies have had a lot of ability to take advantage of that.
Now, Tom Braithwaite from the Financial Times, one of the flashpoints here in this proposal is that the shadow banking system, as it's known, would now be regulated more like regular banks. Everything from AIG and the banking that we now know they did to the financing arm of Target. And they don't want all the regulation that banks have been through, even though it walks like a bank and talks like a bank. With your international perch at the Financial Times, can you respond to the fear that new regulations like these will just drive investors to more shadowy markets overseas?
Well, it certainly happened before. It's driven investors to more shadowy markets like the UK, which obviously isn't particularly dangerous, but in comparison with the US, it has been a lighter touch regime. So if you go back to Sarbanes-Oxley, for example, which put greater disclosure requirements on US markets, London suddenly became a more attractive proposition. That could certainly happen again with Europe taking an upper hand.
Let's listen. Well, Diane Brady, what would the administration say in response to that? Because the way Tom just laid it out, then, hey, what the heck? All this money is going to find all these unregulated nooks and crannies. I mean, I had a guest on the show a couple of months ago who said more regulation in the United States, especially if that regulation is built around transparency, will actually make global investors feel safe and will make more money flow to the United States, because they'll be less afraid of being duped. Which do you think is true?
I think it's a bit mixed. I think the fact, you know, the rule of law and the transparency of our markets has made the U.S. more attractive than a lot of other global markets. But, you know, the reality is markets are global. Some of the things, such as, for example, putting more skin in the game, the banks won't have a lot of choice on that. But AIG's financial products unit, where was it based? It was based in Canary Wharf in England. It was not based here in the U.S.
Now, let's get a couple of more voices on from listeners who have proposals for redesigning Wall Street. Joanne in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I want to know, Barney Frank said within 60 days they will bring back the uptick rule. There's not been a squeak out of them about the uptick rule. That's one thing. And also, they keep telling us buy and hold is dead, so I don't know how they expect to get the regular investor back.
Right.
So I think there should be some incentives for the longer you hold it, the less the capital gains will be. And the third thing, I think those day traders, whom I've heard from my accountant make as much as $8 million a year, that they should have a small tax on their day trades, like 2%, something like that, that would make them think before they just put their finger on the button, buy. And they also get the news from CNN, I understand, from All Things Considered, 15 minutes before the general public. And I think that's insider trading, and that should be outlawed.
Oh, that's a lot, and that's a lot of good stuff. Tom Braithwaite, what's the uptick rule?
The uptick rule would mitigate the opportunities to short sell shares, so to borrow them and sell them with the intent of benefiting from any downward movement in the market. Now, I think the SEC is actually on with considering reinstating the uptick rule, which requires that the stock has to tip upwards before you can short sell the shares. So it's it doesn't ban short selling altogether, but it does reduce the opportunity to do it.
Pat in Maplewood, what would you add to redesign Wall Street?
Well, you know, I wonder whatever happened to the idea of collateral. You know, it just seems to me that a lot of these instruments, complex instruments that got us into so much trouble, wound up being based on nothing. So I'm wondering what your guests think of this.
All right, Diane Brady, collateral.
I think that's an excellent point. That was what did in AIG, the fact that they had $500 billion of obligations that were not backed up or were backed up allegedly by, their insurance and such, which, of course, was not real collateral because that's owed to other people. I think that is one thing that is excellent. We can't, obviously there's a limit to how much collateral, but one of the areas that these regulations are addressing is leverage, which gets into some of the same issues. When you have banks that have 30, 31, 32 times the level of debt to their actual equity, that's a dangerous situation. And one of the reasons, say, the Canadian banks have been stronger is they've had regulations in place that limit the amount of leverage they're about to take on. So I think that is something they're looking at, making lenders put skin in the game. That's another thing. All of this is hopefully making for more judicious risk-taking. That's what they want.
Diane Brady from Business Week, Tom Braithwaite from the Financial Times, and I want to play a clip of Citigroup Chairman Richard Parsons on this show recently. One of the new powers of the Federal Reserve Board under the president's proposals would be explicitly to regulate the banking institutions seen as too big to fail. Joe Nocera was raising the question of whether anything should be too big to fail a little earlier on. And I asked Richard Parsons, chairman of Citigroup, on this show, should any company still be allowed to be too big to fail after what's just happened?
If we're going to maintain our leadership as a leading economy in the world, you're going to have large, complex, interconnected institutions. And so we're just going to have to do a better job of regulating and understanding the risk that they're taking on.
So he said, yes, Tom Braithwaite, we need institutions that are too big to fail. I bet if we took an informal poll of Brian Lehrer Show listeners right now, people would say no. Why should we have an institution that's too big to fail? If we have that, then it means they don't have the right incentives not to take excessive risks because they can be confident that the taxpayers will bail them out. And then, sure enough, it's going to come around to bite everybody, and the taxpayers are going to have to bail them out, as just happened. So what do you think about that? You take Richard Parsons' side on this?
It's a tricky one. I think ultimately, and this is probably where I disagree with Joe Nocera, that there are a couple of big ideas in the proposals, one of which is capital. So big institutions will have to hold a lot more capital. We just don't yet know how much. It's going to be decided over the course of the year. That should make their balance sheets much stronger. Secondly, the new resolution authority, which would give Tim Geithner the possibility of winding up big failing firms, hopefully more cheaply than AIG, but also avoiding the collapse that caused vast damage from Lehman Brothers. That is another big curb on the threat from too big to fail institutions. But it's true that they've decided not to go as far as reinstating the sort of Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment and commercial banking.
Diane Brady, your thoughts on too big to fail and what's changed or unchanged or should be changed in the Obama plan?
Well, I think that personally no institution should be too big to fail, but I think what's happening is they're taking away the incentives, which, you know, we've talked about a bit, but the fact that you don't want to be spending $180 billion to bail a firm out. They are putting in place a structure where you could unwind these firms. The reality is huge firms fail, small firms fail, and you have to allow those firms to take the consequences. That includes the shareholders, the creditors, and everyone else. So I think ultimately they have to be responsible for their actions, and the taxpayer appetite for taking on more of this debt is clearly waning. The anger is huge, and they know they can't do it at this point going forward.
Let's get one more caller in here. Nancy in Montclair is calling in, an ex-New York Fed regulator, I understand. Nancy?
Yes, ex-bank examiner.
Uh-huh. What does that mean you did exactly?
Basically, I went into institutions like Citi and Chase when they were regulated by the Fed and would examine different trading desks, and everything from FX to credit and fixed income derivatives.
And what are you thinking?
Well, you can put in all the regulations you want, but frankly, until the environment is changed, where you have regulators who can go into these institutions and the regulators are as knowledgeable about the people who are trading these products, which they have not been to date, and B, where the environment is one such that where management at regulatory bodies are actually interested in really delving into the desks and finding the real issues rather than coming out with minor points like they have X number of contracts which have not been fully signed off on by both parties, then nothing is going to really change. And that was what the environment was like when I was there.
So can this change?
If you can take a lot of these traders who are now out of jobs and put them into regulatory positions and change management, i.e., you've got Geithner now, who his big push when he was head of the New York Fed was to get institutions together to make sure that all the contracts were signed off, because it's true, there were thousands of contracts that were not finalized, yet that everyone knew that if something happened, and we did have many credit events take place, that people honored them, whereas I didn't really see a lot of action going towards analyzing institutions' risk models, and really we didn't have the manpower to do that kind of thing because we didn't have the quants to be able to examine those models.
Nancy in Montclair, thank you for calling us, and you're going to get the last word in this segment, but this is just the beginning of this conversation, certainly around the country, because this proposal is just in its first draft, as the Obama administration is sending it to Congress. And as this debate begins, this is so important for everyone in the economy. We see how vulnerable everyone is to this banking world, and particularly New York, with our economy's dependence on Wall Street. So, listeners, we want your help. Let's redesign Wall Street together. We have a page now on our website that asks, what should the new banking rules be? Add a rule that you think is important to not crash the economy in the future, like the way it's been kicked to the ground now, or design a bigger picture, a whole template. Do it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show, and we'll come back to this in the coming weeks. And I want to thank Diane Brady from Business Week and Tom Braithwaite from the Financial Times for joining us. Diane and Tom, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehr on WNYC coming up next. Another call-in for Iranians and Iranian-Americans. Word is circulating now about the surprisingly harsh speech given this morning by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. People were hoping for something much more conciliatory in his first public comment since the election. We want your reactions. Will this squelch the movement? Will this just inflame it? Iranians, Iranian-Americans, what are you hearing from over there as well? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll take your calls right after this.